Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Max Verstappen wins Red Bull Racing's 11th straight victory, but only after a resurgent McLaren gives him a run for his money off the line. This is the F1 Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato, and this is Round 10, the British Grand Prix. Silverstone featured another pole, victory and fastest lap for Max Verstappen, but his sixth straight win this season wasn't quite like all the others. First, he lacked his usual massive pace advantage. Second, it was McLaren, not Aston Martin, Mercedes or Ferrari, that was his closest challenger. Lando Norris almost pinched pole and then did pinch the lead off the line. Even Oscar Piastri tried to get ahead of the Dutchman on the first lap. Verstappen eventually got back ahead and established a relatively modest lead, but McLaren had the pace for a comfortable double podium before a safety car got Lewis Hamilton ahead of Piastri. So what does this mean for the second half of the F1 season? To help answer the question if this has changed F1 as we know it, behind Red Bull Racing and Max Verstappen of course, I'm joined by Deputy Editor-in-Chief of Auto Hebdo, Julian Billiott. Julian, welcome back to the Strategy Report.
Hi, mate. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I don't know where you are in the world. It's 7 a.m. in France. I've had two coffees, so I'm barely functioning. But, I'm delighted to be back on the show with you to talk all things F1. So many thanks for the invitation.
Two coffees before 7 a.m. is doing very, very nicely. So but I think people will be able to measure the speed of your voice as we get through the podcast, increasing just gently and gradually. We had quite an interesting race at the British Grand Prix. Okay, we all know who won. We know who wins every week, really, in Formula 1.
Yes.
It's what happened behind that I think was interesting. But it was interesting as well, the gap Max Verstappen had this weekend, winning his sixth Grand Prix in a row, Red Bull's 11th Grand Prix in a row. My goodness, it's only been 10 races this season, but it's the 11th in a row. It seemed reduced at Silverstone, seemed reduced in qualifying and in the race. Now, Silverstone's tended to give us pretty good races over the last couple of years. It's always looked a little bit more competitive. Is it just a fact of the circuit making it look like Red Bull's advantage was a little bit less than it normally is this weekend?
I believe so, and the track layout just makes it, fun for racing, because the corners sort of opens and never really closes down, so you can have some great action. And it was true that the gaps were closer, but if you look at qualifying, we had a wet to dry session, which is always, can change the overall picture. But in the end, Max still managed to pull position, and during the race, even though he was overtaken by Lando under pressure from Oscar early on, as you mentioned, there was little doubt that once the DRS, which is like necessary evil, I don't know, it's pretty bad in my opinion, but still, you could see that even Lando didn't really put up a fight when Max came charging, and the safety car had us a bit on the edge of our seats, and we thought, oh, maybe there might be an opportunity, but then I guess at the restart, the first lap, Max was already 2 seconds up the road, so it was out of DRS range from Lando, so little suspense here, of course the gaps were closer, but there was no doubt, despite the great start to the race, that Max, barring any reliability incident, was going to be the winner once more. But as you mentioned, the most interesting part this year is what is happening right behind him, because the picture keeps changing from one week to another.
Yeah, and something Max actually said after the race is that he's finding it confusing who he's racing every week. I guess racing is in inverted commas because he's not normally racing anyone.
Yeah, exactly.
But theoretically, who he might be racing week to week is always very interesting. This weekend, it was McLaren. I guess largely surprising. We saw a little bit of a hint of this in Austria about a week ago, but Austria has always been a track Lando Norris has done very well at.
Yes.
Oscar, without the upgrades at that track, didn't do as well. So it was really difficult to say, but there were no doubts about how well McLaren did this weekend. It was the second stage of their upgrade as well, and they have one more coming in Budapest or before the end of the break in any case. Is it too early to try and make some somewhat definitive statements about where McLaren is now? I mean, we don't expect them to be second quickest everywhere, but is McLaren a front-running team now, do you think?
As you mentioned, it's really too early to say, because I remember in Spain, Mercedes were super competitive, and we thought, okay, Mercedes is back. I guess Charles Leclerc was second in Austria. Sometimes my memory gets fuzzy because there's so many races coming, you know, thick and fast. And you say, okay, Ferrari have broken through. And then, you know, earlier the year, Aston Martin is the second fastest. So the picture keeps changing from one race weekend to the other. So for this, you know, the second spot behind Max, that it's impossible to say, to be absolute and definitive when you say McLaren is the second fastest team or Aston or Ferrari. What is true, however, is that I look back at the results before our chat, and in Jeddah they were 15th and 17th, Lando Norris, and Piastri and Lando Norris. They had a terrible start to the season, dreadful. I think they barely exited Q1. I'm not even sure they exited Q1 in Bahrain. And the first races were absolutely, you know, really, really bad. And what is, in a normal year, in the Formula One I grew up with, you knew that once you were cooked at the first race, that the whole season was going to be a very long and painful one. And it seems that I don't know if it's the new regulations or something else, but it seems like you can recover pretty quickly, which is amazing, because Bahrain was like 4 months ago. And true, McLaren had admitted very early on that, you know, they had missed the cut with their new car, so maybe the upgrades were already in the pipeline in February or January. But still, their recovery is impressive. And I wouldn't be surprised if later races we'll see Aston coming back. I would see Ferrari perform. I would see Mercedes as well, despite all teams gradually shifting their attentions towards 2024, of course. So I'd say it's still, and I'm not sure we'll get a clear picture behind Max all year long. I think the momentum will keep shifting every race, which is, you know, at least we have something to look forward to.
I've been saying people should be putting a sticker over the first position on their televisions if they're getting bored of watching who's leading, and just pretend number's different.
Yeah, exactly. Checo Perez is making the sport. At least we don't have a Red Bull 1-2 every weekend. We should have a Red Bull 1-2 every weekend if we were honest. But thankfully, Checo, you know, maybe he's going for driver of the day every weekend. Was his recovery from P15 or whatever to P from 3 to 6. But it's the fight for second place. And at some point, I still expect Max to drop one, because, or Red Bull to drop one, because the more races you get, just the probability of them winning everything gets less, because, you know, if we had a normal season like back in the day with only 17 or 18 races, I'd say, okay, they can put it off. We were already like 10 races, should be 11 or 12 if we had Imola and Shanghai. But with 22, I still expect at some point, you know, a poor start, you get collected at the first corner, or you have an issue like you had in qualifying in Jeddah, like a with the engine or something else. So I think we'll see someone else win a race this year, I guess. I mean, someone else than who's not Checo, of course, but another team. So, but to come back, long story short, I'm not sure McLaren will be at the front every weekend. But definitely they are now in that group behind Red Bull, and they've already overtaken Alpine, and they will be. I don't see them catch Ferrari because the gap is quite big for fourth in the constructors, but for sure they'll be fighting for fifth and be able to fight for podiums at more races this year.
We'll get to what McLaren's performance maybe means for the rest of the grid a little bit later, because there were some interesting parallels, like you say, with Alpine and even Mercedes in particular, I think. But to look at their race specifically, qualified second and third, as you said, did really, really a good job off the line to, in fact, get one car ahead of Max Verstappen, even if just for a little bit. But then DRS'd their way behind him, the dreaded DRS, to build a little bit of a gap, which meant they were safe from undercut range. In the end, the safety car meant Lewis Hamilton was able to jump Oscar Piastri, otherwise looked like he was probably going to be safe. There was only really one moment of tension, I guess, in terms of the strategy point of view for McLaren, and that was what tyres they were going to put Lando Norris onto. He was pretty adamant he didn't want the hard tyres. The team gave him the hard tyres. And in the end, it kind of worked out all right, although it's partly, I guess, because the McLaren seems to have pretty good straight line speed. It's always interesting when you hear drivers and teams argue. Like, we hear it a lot from Ferrari, I guess, and maybe for good reason. We don't hear it a lot from McLaren because they're not often in this position. Do you think that because of the stakes, you know, a podium was up for grabs, there needs to be a little bit of development of trust between driver and strategist because they're so unused to doing this?
I must say I was surprised by Lando's tire call. I mean, from the team. And I thought, oh, maybe they don't have any subs available. You know, I don't know, because in qualifying they used too much or whatever. Already with Oscar, who pitted like three laps before the safety car, which ended up costing him the podium, unfortunately. I was kind of on the fence, but I thought, okay, you know, McLaren, they need the points, and they could be targeting a double podium finish. So they went for the safe option with Oscar, who still had like 23 laps. And since he started on mediums, you couldn't put back immediately if you wanted to do one stopper. So you had to go for the safe options of hards. But with Lando, I was really surprised because I thought, okay, it's fewer than 20 laps remaining after the safety car. Everyone else is switching to softs. And we saw with George Russell, we did 29 laps on the softs from the beginning. I mean, different cars, you could say maybe the McLaren would eat up the tires more than the Mercedes, and the engineers knew it. But for me, it was a 50-50 call. It's like it's not a mistake or not a great call. If you keep the second position, you look like a genius. If you drop it, you know you're like zeros. But there was no wrong call in my opinion, because so I double check. So Lando had four scrub sets of softs available to him, so he could have put softs during the safety car, and the hards were not working great. You know, because some drivers had already switched to it, but McLaren seemed confident. At least they were not flip flopping like you hear too often, unfortunately, with Ferrari, when the driver asks, "So what do we do?" And they go, "I get back to you," blah blah blah. It's like, what are you doing? You should have clear cut answers. And at least McLaren, they were adamant. They knew what they wanted to do. And we've seen that even with Lewis and Bono after so many years. Sometimes Lewis is not sure and he's questioning the strategy. It's like, oh, you put me on the wrong tire or blah blah blah. And then the engineer, I think Lando is a new engineer because the voice was different compared to the one I was used to hearing. And somebody sounded a bit annoyed, like when they kept asking him, "Do you think the tires could last or whatever?" I was expecting a Kimi Raikkonen sort of reply, like, "Leave me alone, I know what to do," or "Just let me drive." But in the end, I think it was the right call, because obviously the restart was going to be tough for two or three laps. But since you don't have the DRS, once you have the safety car, you need really to resist for two laps. And we saw Lewis almost overtake Lando at some point. But then once you go through that phase, I think the soft peaked super early, and then you kind of have a drop off. And we saw that the end gap is like over 3 seconds. So once you just have to weather the storm for a couple of laps, and it shows that McLaren has trust in Lando and also in Oscar to be able to manage that phase. And so in the end, they made the right call. But for me, at the time, so I was surprised, but I wouldn't say, okay, it's a mistake. It was 50-50, and if he had put soft, it would have been, let's say, a good decision as well. Sometimes there is no clear right answer or clear wrong answers when you are in that phase. If it were only, I know, 5 laps remaining, okay, you put soft. Mm. But now with 18 or 19, I understand why they did it, because the soft, if they start to drop off, then you are really, you could be in trouble. So in the end, it was the right decision. As you mentioned, you need to build trust, but you need to have, when you ask a question, you need to get like a proper answer from the team. And I know it's difficult. I spoke recently with for Moto Hebdo project with Kimi's former engineer, Julien Simon-Chotin, who's now doing F1 TV and Canal Plus as a consultant. And he says sometimes you have so many data, everything is happening at the same time, so it's hard for the engineers to process everything. You have so many contradictory messages in your earphones. So, but it's true that it helps that the instructions you give out to the drivers, it must be, you must be confident and clear and not show some hesitation, which again, I'm sorry to just to bang on Ferrari, but it seems that every time the drivers is like, we saw it with Carlos Sainz there. It was almost like, do whatever you're sorry, apologies for the language. But like, just do whatever you need to do. Whereas Carlos sometimes used to be someone lobbying for his strategy because he's a very clever guy. And you can see, like, this time was like, okay, I'll do whatever you want, guys. So it's a strange situation at Ferrari. But McLaren, they were no hesitation. You know, it was always, we stick to Haas. We need to have the Haas. Haas are the better option and everything. And sometimes you can't trust too much the data and not rely on the driver's feedback, which I personally like when they, you go through the drivers, but in the end, they are the one driving the car. But in that situation, I think they managed the situation perfectly.
Interesting to consider as well that part of the decision-making ended up being that the decision was made during a virtual safety car and then it became an actual safety car. And I feel like that happens increasingly often now in Formula One, whether it's because race control wants to give itself a bit of time to decide what the best option is, but it does mean that it can affect decisions like this. Ultimately ended up being a good call. And it meant as well, McLaren, could have potentially tried to switch to softs very last minute, but probably would have lost time in pit lane getting them ready. It would have looked silly. So at least a commitment, like you say, is often just better than dithering or, hesitating and waiting. So they committed, trusting the driver can do the job, both drivers on the hards, and they managed to secure what was still a pretty good result, up to fifth in the constructors' standings now. And I think that's really interesting. You touched on a couple of different teams there, and I think McLaren's performance relative to them is what makes it really interesting. I mean, let's just briefly touch on Alpine here, I suppose, before we look at some other strategies.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Another double DNF for this team, the second one or the third one of the year, I think it is. One unreliability, one Lance Stroll problem, which, okay, not Pierre Gasly's fault. That can happen when you're racing near Lance Stroll sometimes, unfortunately. But, I mean, it must be felt most keenly at Alpine, the fact that it looks like McLaren's taken a big step forward. How much does, this big upgrade, and you mentioned it earlier, Aston Martin's done it now, McLaren's done it under these rules. How much does this big jump hurt a team like Alpine that's talking about plans to move to the front in three seasons or four seasons' time?
It makes Alpine's woes or even more painful, because it feels like no matter what is happening, Alpine's like ceiling is finishing P7 or P8. And I know they had a great run at Monaco, but Monaco is such a specific track, and you can't really overtake. So if you qualify well, you're pretty much guaranteed to get a strong result. But apart from that, their season has been pretty poor and disappointing. And the thing that is even more painful for them is the way they handle the situation off track, because I remember over the winter, McLaren right away said, okay, we've missed our targets, and the car that will start the season will not be good. And they say goodbye to James Key. So they were not afraid to take big, bold decisions and, you know, be decisive, just like they did with their strategy at Silverstone. Whereas Alpine was like, I don't know, it sounded like French content. Oh, yeah, we've hit our targets. We will get closer to the top three. We finished P4 last year, which was great results, despite a terrible, you know, readout reliability that probably pushed Fernando Alonso away, among other things. But it felt like, and I remember Esteban Ocon's interviews during the launch of the A523, you know, the car is so much better than last year. It's like a different world. Like, and he said something almost, I double checked because I wasn't sure, but he said, it's almost like we don't need to do winter testing. The car is so good that we, you know, it's like a different world. Okay, but which is, I like that, but when you have that kind of statement, then you need to deliver. You know, it's like Zlatan in football. Zlatan has a big mouth, but Zlatan on the pitch is delivering in and out. I mean, now he's retired, but, you know, he say, I'm the greatest, but when he's on the pitch, he's doing crazy things and very entertaining. Alpine is like, oh, all our targets would get closer to top three. And then you show up and you're like, okay, you're still the fifth fastest, or you've actually, let's say, tumbled down the pecking order, and you're not the fourth fastest team. You more like the fifth fastest in sort of a no man's land until McLaren's recovery. And now you're like the sixth fastest team. You make mistakes in pit stops, or how many penalties they've had this year. I remember Bahrain was a joke. Austria, Ocon had like 35 seconds penalty, which is almost unheard of. And the reliability has been again fairly poor. It really was last year. So it's a very bad look for Alpine when you have teams like McLaren or Aston over the winter making such a huge jump, and you spend all winter saying we've hit all our targets, we will get closer to the front, and then, you know, the thing is they kept saying that. They say, if you look at the gaps, the gaps are closer. Yeah, but the gaps are closer for everyone. It's not like, okay, maybe if you take the overall picture, you've come closer to the very top. But in the meantime, you've been overtaken by two or three other teams. So performance in Formula One is always relative to other. You could have found half a second. If the others have found a whole second, you may have moved forward, but at a slower pace compared to your rivals. You end up in the Constructors' Championship suffering from it. So it's Alpine season has been bad on track, but also off track. I remember in Monaco, so Laurent Rossi, the CEO of the brand, had a big, he had a big interview in Miami where he called out the team like in a big, big spot, which in a way was kind of refreshing. At least he was not hiding behind a rock. He said that they were, you know, amateurish and stuff like that. So very strong word, even in French, because sometimes it sounds worse in English than in French. But in French, it was also pretty strong. To say, like, almost they were having a jolly at the track. You say that, he kind of say that. And then Monaco happened. So you say, okay, look, you know, I had a big argument with everyone, and the team has reacted. And I remember, instead of saying, okay, let's be safe, it's Monaco, blah, 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 some interviews I remember from Monaco were like, oh, no, you know, I expect us in Barcelona to be equally good and to be ahead of Ferrari and Mercedes, and then you show up in Barcelona and you're like P9 or P8 again, and Mercedes had a big jump. The thing is, they never learned. They're like, sometimes you just have to keep a low profile, and until you deliver on track, don't start talking and announcing crazy stuff. Laurent Rossi and his now infamous 100 Grand Prix plan, which is now 120 Grand Prix, and maybe by the end of the year will be a 200 Grand Prix plan. I don't know. It gives that the targets at Alpine just keep being delayed every year. The team has been back in F1 for almost 10 years now, and it feels like it's a moving target. So it's a pretty bad look when you have a team like McLaren, which is able to recover in only 4 or 5 months, and a team of Alpine, which is just I don't know, standing still, really.
It's not a good look for them, and it'll be interesting to see, I guess, points-wise in the Constructors' Championship. Obviously, they are behind now, but then also how big that gap might grow if McLaren's step forward does end up being a permanent, fundamentally, for the rest of this season. It'll be really interesting. Interesting, too, for Ferrari and Mercedes. Now, the gap is pretty big for McLaren, so it seems pretty unlikely they're going to catch them. But in terms of pure pace, McLaren might be quick enough to decide what order those teams finish in the constructor standings purely by just getting in the way, fundamentally. That's what we saw in Silverstone, in part. Let's start with Ferrari, though, looking at this one, because they just had such a strange approach to this whole weekend. You know, there's a bit of optimism after the last couple of races that things were improving at Ferrari after their upgrades. Felt like car was a bit more consistent, like tyre was a little bit better. Then they rocked up here, decent in qualifying. You know, Charles Leclerc probably could have been on the front row had he not made a mistake on his last lap, and they weren't too far off. But then in the race, just was so conservative. You know, kept a very slow pace, went straight for the hard tyre, were behaving essentially like witches' hats on the road for Mercedes and eventually Sergio Perez to pass them. I mean, does it make it too hard to judge the car's true pace after a race like this? Is it all just a bad approach again from Ferrari this weekend?
I think for me, it's a bit of both. Is that they were scared of, because they have been beaten so bad this year by tire wear and the car being unpredictable and unstable. So I think, and Charles missed the FP2, the electrical problem. I don't know if it had anything to do with Mattia Binotto being on Pfizer. I don't remember. They had a big fallout last year at that track. That's probably the start of the end for Mattia at Ferrari, remember, with the strategy and Carlos winning the race and Charles Leclerc being a bit, left out by the strategy. But no, joking aside, I think they are seeing ghosts. That's why I say, oh my God, because they pitted so early with Charles. I was like, what are you doing? And you have all the others just almost went past the halfway mark. Even George Russell started on softs, did 29 laps, and then they stopped. I remember I had the lap, look there, 18th. So which is like 10 laps before pretty much everyone, and they started on mediums like most guys. So I was really surprised by that. And but I guess it's just because they were not confident, especially with Charles' car having missed the FP2. They don't know how the tires would behave or the long run. Maybe they tried a two-stopper and an aggressive strategy. It feels like they, as you mentioned, the approach was not the right one, because again they had bad memories from earlier races where tire wear has been pretty terrible and the car unstable, and it all became sort of a perfect storm of strategy being super, let's say, super vague and not decisive, unlike other teams, and everything conspired for them to ended up just on the fringes of the top 10 with the safety car as well. Carlos Sainz asking for a wall, say, guys, what do we do? And then they were left, it's just indecisive. So I don't know. I expect Ferrari to be strong at some races or some weekends, and others be like back to their woos, really, like we saw last weekend. Previous weekend in Austria, I was fairly strong. Charles in the podium. But Charles has always been good in Austria. It's a track he likes. He also likes Silverstone. And then we saw him qualifying. He mentioned he could have been on the front row, and I agree. But they were quite confident after quali, you know, P4, P5. It's, in a year like 2023, it's a fairly decent result for Ferrari. But in the race, they were like, it's like everything that could go wrong has gone wrong. I mean, they still managed to finish with the two cars, but it's just, it's a mixture of everything. The car is not great. Definitely the car is a massive step back compared to last year. And I fear that they had a small window of opportunity last year to finally end their title or championship drought. And it feels like the way, maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong for the tifosis, but I feel like until 2026, Ferrari would not be able. It's like, okay, we're back to another long period of little hope for Maranello, I'm afraid.
I don't think that's too unfair of a call. I mean, it feels like Ferrari is struggling a lot even to understand what it has from its car. You know, you talk about those early tyre changes. I understand why Ferrari would be worried about high tyre wear. That's been the story of the whole season pretty much for the car. But, you know, there were signs, just the cooler conditions, for example, and George Russell being able to start on soft tyres, that the race was going to be less aggressive for tyre wear, and that maybe the car still is a little bit better on its tyres since it was upgraded. It's hard to say, obviously, because we've had so few races and they played their hand so conservatively this weekend, but it just feels like there's a lot of uncertainty there. Similar to Mercedes, I guess, you know, they've had their big upgrade in the last month or two. In Monaco it was, and as you mentioned, in Barcelona it looked good. But now they're starting to, you know, they creep in this feeling that, well, actually at some tracks it's not that good, and I think we just need to think about next year. It's a lack of decisiveness or understanding, I think, that makes this season so interesting. And I mean, Aston Martin for the last two rounds have been nowhere as well. Like, it's really changeable, and it's very interesting that it seems like all these teams aren't fully on top of what their cars are. But it does make it interesting. There's one more point I want to get to before we wrap this one up, and that is the second Red Bull car. We'll finish, I guess, where we started, and that was Sergio Perez. Now, his recovery was harmed a little bit by the timing of that safety car. He'd also already made his pit stop. And you can kind of understand, I guess, why they'd stop Perez early. He was going for an aggressive strategy to make up places, so that kind of makes sense, whereas Hamilton stayed out to get the safety car, and that made sense for him. But, you know, qualifying is his problem at the moment, isn't it? You know, he's giving himself too much work to do, and he was sent to the end of the pit lane in Q1 when it was cold and wet. His tyres lost temperature. It's not the only reason he didn't make it through Q1, because other drivers did. But do you think the team needs to take a bit more responsibility for helping build up his confidence, or is he almost a bit of a spiral and a lost cause at this point?
I mean, Checo is like 33. He's been there for 12 years. He's had so many race starts. He's won many Grand Prix, and I'm really surprised by the fact that he's not able to just bring everything together in qualifying. So, okay, as you mentioned, so the conditions in quali were a bit uncertain, from wet to dry, and in that circumstances, it's always like the last man taking the checkered flag will get the fastest lap. So, and at some point, I think Perez was like second fastest or almost fastest in Q1. Yeah, he was fastest in Q1, and then the times just tumbled down. But for me, this is on the team. Like, you should be able to making, like, say, I think Gasly crossed the line like with 2 seconds left before his final fire and managed to be third fastest in the end or something like that, or at least comfortably in Q2. So for me, the timing here was, yeah, on the team. But when you hear, oh, the team needs to help him build confidence, it sounds like he's not Pierre Gasly in 2018, he's not Alex Albon in 2020. I mean, Checo Perez has a wealth of experience, so he should be able to handle that kind of things. So the team doesn't need to build his confidence. I don't know what's happening. The thing is, it feels at Red Bull that the car is set up and designed and everything is made for Max, and which I can understand because the guy is just pure fire and a rocket. And he delivers week in, week out. But even a guy like, I'm sure if someone, I'm not sure someone else can actually perform like decently against Max in that configuration, in that team with a car properly set up and designed for him. It's so, I think the setup is so extreme at Red Bull that, you know, it's tailor-made for Max and Max only. So I don't want to pile down on Checo too much, even though he should be on the podium every weekend, and Red Bull should be, securing 1-2s at every race pretty much. But it feels like I'm not sure, like someone like Daniel Ricciardo, which is of interest for you guys in Australia, I'm not sure he would be doing any better. I'm not sure anyone else on the grid would do, even Hamilton or Norris. I know he's friend with Max. I feel like everyone else would look terrible next to Max because the team revolves around him, the car is set up for his liking. So and this is going back to your questions, this is the team's responsibility, but more in that sense, that they need maybe to accommodate to understand that Formula One, despite being, you know, they always say it's a team sport, but in the end you only have it's one driver against 19 other drivers, and but they need to bear in mind that they have two cars, and maybe they can accommodate for Checo a bit more. But when you see Max's success and the car, I mean, he's leading the constructors' championship by 52 points on his own. So you could argue that, you know, Checo is like, it's like, you know, luxury or bonus. So, and you could put anyone else next to Max, they still win both championships because the car is so good and Max is so good as well. I mean, maybe I've sounded too critical, but Max is doing a fantastic job. Max is a fantastic driver, one of the best in ever, and someone I really like to watch. Very entertaining. Very entertaining also off track when he wants to say something spicy. So I don't want to blame Max for sort of the lack of interest or the lack of suspense in Grand Prix racing in 22 and 23. But very, very bizarre. It feels like, I don't know if you can use that in Formula One, but in other sports we have something called the yips.
Mm.
Like, I don't know, okay, do you have that in Australia or?
Yeah, yes.
It's like, or in French we say the fear of winning, which sounds super French, the fear of winning. we prefer losing with flair and panache, but the fear of winning is like everyone expects you to win or at least to be P2 every weekend, and then you start to, you know, gradually, let's say, crumble under the pressure and the expectations. And even someone like Checo, and then you have the journalist asking him, so why, you know, how come you don't qualify for Q3? And then you have always someone going to Helmut Marko who says, you know, always friendly stuff to you, like his head is not in the right place or whatever, or he talks too much about the championship or whatever. So it's a very, very difficult environment. Red Bull, Eddie, you know, and it's tailor-made for Max because Max is a ruthless competitor. So he can, you know, thrive in that environment, but anyone else will struggle. But it's, I don't know, it feels like the self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like every weekend now everyone expects Checo to not go into Q3, and maybe, I don't know, unconsciously, maybe Checo puts too much pressure on himself. He's like, oh, you know, it's like you have an open goal and you still miss the goal because you're like, man, it's so easy. It should be so easy, and yet I still fail. So it's, but I'm sure it's a phase, and after the summer break he'll come back and he'll score podiums and he'll probably score a couple more wins when Max is not there for any reasons. But it's true that it's a very, let's say, head scratching phase that Checo is on at the moment.
Yeah, we'll wait and see. A lot of people will be happy to see him bounce back, not least Red Bull, I suppose, because if Max is going to have a reliability problem or whatever, they need someone to keep that winning streak alive, don't they?
Yeah, they want to beat McLaren's.
Yeah.
They've just equaled them, although McLaren was 11 in the same season, 98. So maybe in 15 or 20 years time we'll look back and say, I'll remember the great years of Red Bull winning everything. It's just like we do now, we'll remember. But I guess we look back fondly on McLaren because you had Senna and Prost.
Mm.
So and yes. It was a proper fight. Now it's only Max and Max, that's it.
Makes a difference. Does make a difference. But who knows what the second half of the year has in store. Maybe some of the other teams will catch up, but that's only because Red Bull will be looking at next year anyway. So
yeah,
it's a bit of a double-edged
sword. I don't expect that at all. I feel like, you know, they want to go and have 22 wins out of 22 races. They want, which could be something. The really thing to look forward is like at some point you get from, okay, oh, it's boring, Max is winning every weekend, to, oh, he's winning every weekend, could he go the whole way?
Like, yes, we saw, completely agree.
Like in McLaren, they won in 88, 15 races out of 16, and there was that famous Italian Grand Prix, the 1 month after Enzo Ferrari's death, and Senna tripping over Backmaker, and then Ferrari had a 1-2. So as you grow closer, the stakes will get higher and you will have that tension and pressure, unless they drop one like it here before the summer break. But if they stay, let's say, unbeaten until the summer break, that would be at least something to look forward to over the second half of the year.
Completely agree. At some point, even people who don't want domination start supporting domination for a perverse reason.
Yeah, exactly. Just to see, okay, is something, okay, when is the streak going to end? You're actually watching to see them, not to see them fail, but to see, okay, this is greatness actually under our eyes, and we should be more appreciative. But, you know, as journalists, we always complain about everything. Or maybe it's only French journalists, I don't know. But, hats off to Max and Red Bull. And if they were to win 22 races, then so be it, and it would be, you know, something crazy to document and witness.
It would be incredible to see. We are edging closer to that. But for now, just another win for Max. 6 in a row, 11 or 10 in a row for this season anyway. And they'll be going for the 12 before the mid-season break. Julian, it was great to catch up and talk about the British Grand Prix with you.
Well, thank you very much again for your invitation. And it'd be always a pleasure to talk all things F1 with you, Michael.
McLaren isn't about to change the outcome of the 2023 title. It might not even be a regular podium contender this season. But if it's made the jump into the front-running pack behind Red Bull Racing in the same season Aston Martin's done the same, it'll confirm we're experiencing something of a paradigm shift in how much teams can expect to gain in a single year. It's a fascinating idea, and thanks very much to Julian for joining me to discuss it. You can subscribe to The Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a rating and a review to help spread the word. You can also find us on social media. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. Special thanks to Ben Loke from Bloke Designs for the show artwork, and our theme music is by Simon Hosford. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll catch you in a couple of weeks for the Hungarian Grand Prix.
Sports stars. They're like superheroes.
But they're actually real.
Which is why we've made a podcast about them. You see,
they've all got a story.
But too many of these stories were cut short.
Kobe Bryant.
Payne Stewart.
Flo Jo.
Phil Hughes.
Justin Fashanu.
We're writing episodes about all of them.
And sadly, many more.
Death of a Sports Star. A new series from Crowd Network.